want to welcome all of you
to this, one of the poetry reading series that Marsh Chapel has been doing over the last 2 or 3 years. And surely the high point of our whole series together to have Professor Jeffrey Hill. As many of you know, he has been ill and has made a supreme effort to come and join us, so our greatest appreciation goes to him. To introduce him formally, I've asked my colleague Shelley Jankowski-Smith, who is our poet in residence and his student in the creative writing program, to make the introduction. Shelley?
Good evening and welcome to Marsh Chapel. This evening, the Marsh Chapel Poetry Reading Series is pleased to welcome the distinguished poet Jeffrey Hill back once again to read from his latest work. Jeffrey Hill is a university professor, a professor of literature and religion at Boston University, as well as the founding co-director of the Editorial Institute. He has published 7 books of poetry, 2 books of literary criticism, and will read tonight from his most recent book of poems, The Triumph of Love. After the reading, Professor Hill will be happy to sign books in the downstairs Robinson Room, and BU Barnes & Noble has set up a book sale table downstairs so you can purchase books after the reading. You're also invited to join a reception downstairs with refreshments in the Thurman Room. And now, with deepest appreciation, we welcome Jeffrey Hill.
I apologize. This won't be one of my more con brio performances. I'll do my best. Great oaks and little acorns grow, oh, the modesty of the man. And one of the motives behind the writing of the new book, The Triumph of Love, can you hear me all right? At the back, is that okay? Okay, fine. One of the numerous motivations that set the new book off was my entirely accidental discovery that the diminutive or pet form of my first name occurs in a Latin poem, the Vox Clamantis of John Gower, which was a diatribe against the peasants' revolt in 1381. It features in a number of lines that go like this, what vocat tom venit, sim retardit, col furit, quem jef juvat, grig rapit, dum dor strepit, comes est quibus hob. That really accounts for the certain tonality. One or two illustrations might help us, Jeff, to take a fix on your position, anomalous as it is. 2 Kokoschkas and 1 Rembrandt. Rembrandt's unfinished The Concord of the State, okay. The Masaryk portrait and What We Are Fighting For, okay. Okay. Ta-ra, ta-ra, ta-ra-ra-ra-ra. Milton, the political pamphlets. Blake in old age reaffirming the hierarchies. Peggy Passim, virtually. Bernanos, if only for having written La colère des imbéciles remplit le monde. Radnoti ad bo, the great self-recovery of Watt. Ta-ra, ta-ra, ta-ra-ra-ra-ra. Morning registers a celebration. Haydn at 66, his clowning majesty of invention never bettered. He means, I think, the late Erdödy Quartet's Ed. Bartok dying in New York, unfinished music among the sickbed detritus. Ta-ra, ta-ra, ta-ra-ra. I would have liked to know, I may yet know, whether the hidden part which most engages me is closer to nub, crux, crank, or orifice. Crank, probably. The system which converts rotary to rectilinear motion is called the eccentric. Whichever it is, it has my tie. Ta-ra, ta-ra, ta-ra-ra-ra-ra. The nerve required to keep standing, pedaling, grinning inanely, strikes me, splat, as more than temperamental luck. It is a formal self-distancing, but like choreography. You could clog to some late Haydn without injuring either tradition. Please, my foot! Ta-ra, ta-ra, ta-ra-ra-ra-ra. I think another motive probably, though I'm less certain about this, is a review I got some 20 or more years ago. I have a wonderful long-term memory, which is just as well, because my short-term memory is shot to pieces. I have a wonderful long-term memory, and I bear grudges, which I repent. And there was a review of one of my earlier books called The Mystery of the Charity of Charles Peguy, which the reviewer said that, in her opinion, Hill had not done his stint, which I think meant that Hill had not suffered enough. Here's a section which may possibly stem from that. Confound you, croaker, you and your righteous censure. I have admitted many times my absence from the salient, from the coal face in Coombs Pit Thornhill. Yes, to my shame, I hightailed it at Pozières. Butterworth died in my place. At Arras, I sacrificed Edward Thomas, the chief cause of your hostility. Why can't you say so? I find your certitudes offensive. My cowardice is not contested. I am saying simply, what is to become of memory? Yes, I know, I've asked that before. And here's another in the same vein. The glowering carnival Kermes of Wrath, the pressure's beginning to tell now, you can hear it, the creaking bounce of the Miltonics. But to my task, I ask you. He also cribs from Dryden and Vox Clamantis. Recently it's got much worse. Like a provincial actor-manager. What's more, when Arno blundered at Firenze and the bronze baptistry doors bulged like tarpaulins, when the flesh of the frescoes knew corruption, he wasn't there, as Croker pointed out. And the third, which I hope subsumes and transcends the pettiness of those two other versions. Obnoxious means far back within itself, easily wounded. But vulnerable, proud anger is, I find, a related self of covetousness. I came late to seeing that. Actually, I had to be shown it. What I saw was rough and still pains me. Perhaps it should pain me more. Pride is our crux. Be angry, but not proud, where that means vainglorious. Take Leopardi's words, or to be accurate, BV's English cast of them. When he found Tasso's poor scratch of a memorial, barely showing among the cold slabs of defunct pomp, it seemed a sad and angry consolation. So, Croker, Maxica, O'Shem, I ask you, what are poems for? They are to console us with their own gift, which is like perfect pitch. Let us commit that to our dust. What ought a poem to be? Answer, a sad and angry consolation. What is the poem? What figures? Say, a sad and angry consolation. That's beautiful. Once more, a sad and angry consolation. Since the Triumph of the Loves come out uncharacteristically for me so soon after the appearance of Canaan, and since I see that Canaan is on sale downstairs, I will include a few of the Canaan poems in this next section of the reading, which I call the Aubrey's Ghost section of the reading. I take that title from something in the 17th century gossips, John Aubrey's memoirs, in which he refers to an apparition which, when accosted, made no response, but vanished with a sweet savor and a most melodious twang. And these, I think, are the Aubrey's Ghost poems from Canaan. The first, that man as a rational animal desires the knowledge which is his perfection. Abiding provenance, I would have said, the question stands, even in adoration, clause upon clause, with or without assent, reason and desire on the same loop. I imagine singing, I imagine getting it right. The knowledge of sensuous intelligence entering into the work. Spontaneous happiness, as it was once given our sleeping nature to awake by and know, innocence of first inscription. Of coming into being and passing away. Rosa Saracea, its red spurs blooded with amber, each lit and holy grain the sun makes much of, as of all our shadows. Prodigal, ever-returning darkness that in such circuits reflects diaternity to itself and to ourselves yields nothing, finally, but by occasion visions of truth or dreams as they arise to terms of grace where grace has surprised us. The unsustaining, wondrously sustained. Is this still all right? Can you still hear at the back? Somebody just put their hand up if you can hear. Okay, fine. De anima. Salutation. It is as though effortlessly to reprise the unsung spirit. Gestures of no account become accountable. Such matters arising, whatever it is that is sought through metaphysics, research into angelic song ending as praise itself. The absolute yet again atoned with a contingent, typology incarnate, Bethlehem, the open field. Still to conceive no otherwise, an aphasia of staring wisdom, the soul's images glassily exposed, fading to silver point. Still to be at the last ourselves and masters of all humility. Whether the virtues are emotions, overnight, the inmost self-made outcast, here plighting annihilations, unfinished business of eros, the common new men of waking reverie where you had dreamt to be absolved, and with the day, forsakenness, the new bride brought forth, carnal desuetude, her mystic equity, her nature's ripped hardihood, the radiant windrose where a storm emptied its creels, thrusting a lanthus that is called the tree of heaven. I hope you feel that my subheading for this part of the reading is appropriate, and that these poems do, when challenged, vanish with a sweet savor and a most melodious twang. Whether moral virtue comes by habituation, it is said that sometimes even fear drops away, exhausted. I would not deny that. Self-expression, you could argue, the first to go, immolated selfhood the last. Deprivation, therefore, dereliction even, become the things we rise to. Ethereal conjecture taking on humankind's heaviness of purchase, the moral nebulae common as lichen, the entire corpus of ruinous sagesse, moved by some right and pace of being, as by earth in her slow approaches to withdrawal, the processionals of seared array. just a few words apropos the Aubrey's ghost poems. This whole question of difficulty. When people speak about poems being difficult, poetry being difficult, I think what they have in their mind is difficulty is a kind of crossword or conundrum difficulty, and that a poem gives you some clues, and you have to work these clues out pretty fast to have got the answer before the poem finishes. And if you fail somehow, you know, this is an ignominy. I'd like to give some thought to the possibility that the difficulty of poetry is in essence its democracy. We are all difficult. We are difficult to each other, and we are mysterious to each other. One encounters in any ordinary day more difficulties, more mystery than a volume of poems could present you with. And I've never been quite able to understand why it is or how it is that an art, whether painting, prose, music, or poetry, should have to be less than difficult in that kind of ordinary human way. I think what one needs to feel is the presence of a living entity, but not that one has something squared out on graph paper by a person who thinks that he or she is cleverer than you are. I think there's a sense in which good poems can be in part baffled by themselves. I think that poems do not always know the outcome of their own feelings, except in that rich and imprecise way that we intuit possible answers to those things in life which baffle us. So I've worked out a kind of moral paradox myself, that the difficulty of poetry is its democracy, and the constant demand for more and more simplicity and accessibility in art is dangerous. It plays into the hands of the tyrants, as better people than I have remarked on numerous earlier occasions. A number of poems in The Triumph of Love deal with angels, and I would like to read a few of those now. Let him alone, let him have his way, let him be touched by his own angel. It will come to nothing. Born again, but stillborn. From the angels of irrational decision and of reversed order, to the angel of improvisation. From the angel of improvisation to the angels of tannic acid, salicyl, and plain water. From the angel of advantage, where is the angel of recorded delivery? From the angels of advantage lost, of sacrifice, of surrender, to the angels of merciful intervention and final custody. To the short-sighted citizen angel, the angel of assimilation, I will not run, dance, kowtow to entertain thugs, perverts, parvenus, perjurers. From the stifled lamentation angel, to that dying power, from the trim, well-clad angel of death, his insignia and instruments. From that to the violated angel of eternal audit, and to eternity, the ashen-fleshed, wrenched silent, untouched, unhearing angel of forgiveness. From the terrible angel of procreation to the angel in hiding of senility, to the autonomous angel from the several angels of solitude, CC, angel of self-alienation, angel of solitary confinement, from the angel of the morning gold fix to the angels of mandragora and ripoff, to the demotic angels, from the angels of repulsion attraction, the loud-winged angels of equal sacrifice, the soul angel standing in for hope and despair. To the angel of the approved estimates, to the angels of promise across the entire spectrum, to the surplus angels of acquisition, I cannot even hear the new instructions, let alone obey them. Where, you will say, does explanation end and confession begin? To know all is to forgive all, a maxim more wicked even than it is stupid. Forgive me, would you ever? But that, by my reckoning, is not the sum. I have introduced, it is true, laus et vituperatio as a formality. Still, this formal thing is less clear in situ. That possibly is why I appeal to it. The angels of sacral equivocation, they now tell me, are redundant. We have lost the bloody question. Vide State Trials Elizabethan, ed. Though you can count on there being some bloody question or other, one does more than barely survive. Less hangs on the outcome or by or around it. Why do I think urgently of beach sewage? At one source, Moltke, the two Bonhoeffers, von Heften, suffered the bloody question and did nobly thereby. Late praise costs nothing. To the angels of inconclusive right on both sides, to the angel of the last minutes, to the angel of our estimated times of arrival and departure. And one angel poem from Canaan called Ritornelli. Angel of tones, flame of accord, exacting mercies, answerable to rage as solace, I will have you sing. For so the judgment passes, it is not otherwise. Hereafter, you will see them resolved in tears. They shall bear your crowns of redress. Lost to no thought of triumph, he returns upon himself, goes down among water and ash, and wailing sounds, confused with sounds of joy. The next few poems are from the most nearly or autobiographical section of the new book. They're poems dealing with the Second World War. I need to explain that in the first one I read, the battle is a reference to a British plane of about 1940 called the Fairy Battle, which was just, was, I think, must hold the would hold the record for the worst warplane ever built if it were not for the Brewster Buffalo. The same company, the ferry aircraft company, made a biplane torpedo bomber, which was, in his own odd way, much more efficient. And the Lancaster, in the second poem I shall read, is again, it's a British warplane. At seven even, I knew the much-vaunted battle was a dud. First it was a dud, then a gallant write-off. Honor the young men whose eager fate was to steer that droopy coke against the Meuse bridgeheads. The fairy swordfish had an ungainly frail strength. Cranking in at sea level, wheels whacked by channel spindrift. Ingratitude still gets to me, the unfairness and waste of survival. A nation with so many memorials, but no memory. By what right did Keyes, or my cousin's Lancaster, or the trapped below decks watch of Peter's clangorous old destroyer escort, serve to enfranchise these strange children, pitiless in their ignorance and contempt? I know places where grief has stood mute howling for half a century, self grafted to unself, till it is something like these now familiar alien hatreds, coarse efflorescence over the dead proprieties, strong words of Christian hope, sub rosa, the unmentionable graffiti. You say how you're struck by the unnatural brightness of marigolds. And is this manic or what? Are clowns depressives? The open secret is to act well. Can the now silent witnesses be questioned? What hope remains to get him out alive? I'm sorry, her. Tomorrow he died. Became war dead, picked off the sky's face. 50 years back, the dead will hear and be broken. Get off the line. Who are you to say I sound funny? Whose lives are hidden in God? Whose? Who can now tell what was taken, or where, or how, or whether it was received? How ditched, divested, clamped, sifted, overlaid, raked over, grassed over, spread around, rotted down with leaf mold, accepted as civic concrete, reinforceable base cinder blocks, tipped into Danube, Rhine, Vistula, dredged up with the Baltic and the Pontic sludge, committed in absentia to solemn elevation, Trauermusik, musique funèbre, funeral music for male and female voices, ringingly a cappella, made for double-string choirs, congregated brass, choice performers on baroque trumpets, hefting like glassblowers, inventions of supreme order. What remains, you may well ask? Construction or deconstruction? There is some poor mimicry of choice, whether you build or destroy. But the Psalms, they remain. And certain exultant canzoni of repentance, secular oppugnancy, laus et vituperatio, the worst remembered, least understood of the modes. Add political satire. Add the irrefutable grammar of Abdiel's defiance. And if not wisdom, then something that approaches it nearly. And if not faith, then something through which it is made possible to give credence, if only to Isaiah's prophetically suffering servant, if only by evidence of the faithful women, Ruth and Naomi, as they were and as Rembrandt sees them, the widowed generations, the irrevocable covenant with Abraham, which you scarcely recall. Here's another angel poem, though slightly more satirical than the earlier ones I read. The hierarchy, sorry. The hierarchies are here to be questioned. Lead on, Angelus Novus. Show one-time experts presenting aniline dyes as the intensest expressions of coal tar. Let others develop man's determinate action, for so Peirce dubbed it in the wake of Chickamauga. Failing these, bring others well-tried in the practical worlds of illusion, builders of fabled masks, their dancing clients vanishing into the work, made up as lords and spiky blackamoors. Unveil the dust-wrapped post-war architect's immediate prize designs in balsa wood, excelling fantasies sparsely inhabited by spaced-out pinhead model citizens, Florentine piazzas for Antarctica, the augurs, finally, strangely possessed by doubt whether to address the saturnine magistrates concerning the asteroid, or the asteroid on the nature of destiny and calculation. The concluding short section, I've called for the purposes of this reading, Poor Old Guy, Will Somebody from Community Outreach Please Help Him On to the Tea? Obstinate old man, Senex sapiens it is not. What is he saying? Why is he still so angry? He says, I cannot forgive myself. We are immortal. Where was I? Prick him. Shameless old man, bent on committing more public nuisance, incontinent fury wetting the air, impotently bereft satire, charged with erudition, put up by the defense to be his own accuser. Excuse me, I did not say the pain is lifting. I said the pain is in the lifting. No, please forget it. Mea culpa, Jeff Juvat. Take out supposition, insert suppository. For definitely the right era, read deaf in the right ear. So what is faith if it is not inescapable endurance? Unrevisited, the ferns are breast high, head high, the days lustrous with their hinterlands of thunder. Light is this instant, far seeing into itself. its own signature on things that recognize salvation. I am an old man, a child. The horizon is Traherne's country. And three valedictory poems from Canaan. Sorrel, which is a wild plant in my homeland, and it has the poem bears an epigraph, very common and widely distributed. It is called Sorra in some parts of Worcestershire. Memory worsening, let it go as rain streams on half visible clatter of the wind lapsing and rising, that clouds the pond's green mistletoe of spawn, seeps among nettle beds and rust-brown sorrel, perpetual ivy burrowed by weak light, makes carved shapes crumble, the ill-weathering stone, salvation's troth-plight, plumed of the elect. Pisgah. I am ashamed and grieve, having seen you then those many times, as now you turn to speak with someone standing deeper in the shade, or fork a row, or pace to the top end where the steep garden overlooks the house. Around you the cane lodges, tent poles, trellises, the flitter of sweet peas caught in their strings, the scarlet runners, blossom that seems to burn an incandescent aura towards evening. This half-puzzled, awkward surprise is yours. You cannot hear me or quite make me out. Formalities preserve us. Perhaps I too am a shade. And to finish, a short poem, which I think is very appropriate to read in the chapel of a Methodist foundation, even while I acknowledge this is an interdenominational chapel. The university is a Methodist foundation, because it's a poem to William Law, the early 18th century mystic who was a great influence, early influence, on the Wesleys. It's called To William Law in Absentia. Before I begin, I would like to thank you for your patience and courtesy listening to me this evening, when I know that my delivery is not as good as I would have hoped. To William Law in Absentia. To fall asleep in the flesh is nothing. Resurrection challenges torment. There is always the deist's Eden, a measured exile at home among our mourning cedars. Looking back, it is you I see stand quiet, exact, under the tree of conviction. Image to mirage, mirage withdrawing to skein light. Light to the unmoved, miraculous pool of Siloam. Thank you.